You're listening to The Point. The daughter of a diplomat, Grace Kennan Warnicke, lived in 7 countries and spoke 5 languages before the age of 11. She married into a newspaper dynasty, but eventually found her way out of the shadow of others to forge a dynamic career of her own. She is the chairman of the board of the National Committee on American Foreign Policy and a Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars Fellow. Grace Kennan Warnicke's recently published memoir is Daughter of the Cold War, and she joins us from her home in New York on the phone. Good morning.
Good morning, Mindy. So nice to talk to you.
You too. Your father was George Kennan, who had a distinguished career in the Foreign Service. So tell us a little bit more about him and your relationship.
Well, my father ended up being the American. He was a career Foreign Service officer. He ended up being the American ambassador to the Soviet Union in 1952. He served only 6 months because he was declared persona non grata, or kicked out, if you want to put it more familiarly, by Stalin. But what he's really well known for is having been the architect of the containment policy, which was our policy towards the Soviet Union for almost 50 years. And that's what he's still well known for today. And it was basically a policy of not going to war, but letting the Soviet Union, he always felt it was going to implode, and then, in fact, it did.
Now, your mother was Norwegian, and when you were little, you spent a great deal of time with your Norwegian grandparents, the Sorensens, while your parents traveled. And you write in the book that they gave you a strong sense of family and place. So describe your relationship with your grandparents and Norway.
Well, we moved all the time. I never went to the same school 2 years in a row until I was in the 11th grade. And I studied in different countries. We were always moving. It was always a new place. And so the place we did go in the summers whenever we could, except, of course, World War II, was in Norway. And I had a very, very grandmotherly grandmother who cooked and hugged and put special dolls under the tree. And Norway was for me. My American grandparents were dead by the time I was 3, so I didn't have that over here. And also my mother, like all Norwegians, likes going to Norway every summer, and our house was on the fjord, and it was very special.
Now, your childhood, as you meant, spent moving around a great deal, and on several occasions, your mother left you with various relatives while she went off to be with your father. When she was living with you, she was often out. So how would you characterize your relationship with your mother?
It's an interesting question. I would say it was not the best. I think I was born too soon. I was born 9 months after they were married. And she was a young Norwegian woman from a small town. Her father owned the hardware store. And I think she was getting to know my father, and suddenly this baby appears. And I think as a result, she really kind of pushed me aside in order, I think, to get to know my father better, because she later had 3 other children and did not have the same relationship with them that she did with me. I had a harder time, I guess.
Yeah. Now, your family moves to Moscow in 1944, and your parents enroll you in a Russian school. And although you spoke Russian when you were very young, you'd forgotten it by this time. So what stands out to you about that experience?
Boy, everything stands out to me about that experience. I was the only foreigner in the school. There was a Chinese daughter of a Chinese communist, but I never even met her. She was in another grade. And the principal originally didn't want to take me, but my father very cleverly, and this is very much George Kennan, had studied the law, and he knew that by law, all schools had to take somebody who lived in their geographical neighborhood, which we did. And so I was accepted. But of course, I sat there for I was 12 years old. I sat there for 3 months, not understanding a word, just sitting there and listening to this language kind of flow over me. But of course, I must have been paying attention, because suddenly I began to understand. And then after that, I took, you know, I participated, I talked in class and all the rest of it. But it was very different. They all were dressed in brown and black, and my mother insisted on having me wear American clothes, so I stood out like a peacock and a flock of gray hens or something.
It was tough for you, too, because you got special treatment, which doesn't, usually make friends easily when you get special treatment.
No. Well, actually, they were quite nice, but then I did have special treatment, and they would tell me the day before they were going to call on me. And that was the worst, in a way, because, of course, they were never told a day in advance that they were going to be called on. But I still had some friends, so I wasn't without friends in this Soviet school. But they were very curious. I mean, they would lift up my skirts to see what Americans wore underneath and things like that, which were humiliating to me.
Yeah.
They weren't trying to bully me. They were just curious. Odd thing that had fallen into their midst.
Now, you moved a number of times, both within the U.S. and abroad, attended, as you mentioned before, a number of different schools. You spent long periods of time separated from your parents. So how did this childhood shape you and influence some of your decisions as an adult?
It's hard for me to see the connection in a way, because, of course, at the time, I thought all children lived like me. I mean, I didn't really compare myself. It's always made me a little bit of the outsider looking in, because when I returned to America after having lived in Portugal and Russia and went to first time to an American public school, I was in ninth grade at Alice Deal Junior High School, and then nobody spoke to me because I was so different. So I was different in Russia, and then on the opposite, I was different when I came back here. I think that was hard. I worked very, very hard in high school or in junior high school and high school I just wanted people to like me, to be honest. I just wanted to be spoken to. And I made ridiculous decisions. I decided that sports was the way, but I picked the wrong sport. I picked archery. As you probably know, archery doesn't win you a bunch of friends. It's just not a social sport. Finally, I went into field hockey, which was better. But, I mean, it's made me aware of the problems of being the outsider, aware of being the new person on the block. And it's also made me maybe work harder than most people. And when I'm in a difficult situation, I'm kind of used to the fact that I'm in a difficult situation.
Now, while you're
makes sense.
Yeah, no, it does. It makes perfect sense. And while you're in college, your father is appointed ambassador to the Soviet Union, and the family moves back to Moscow, and you join the family during the summer. So describe life in the Soviet Union under Stalin. This was at the height of the Cold War.
It was at the height of the Cold War, but of course, we were very isolated. We didn't really officially meet practically any Russians. I don't remember meeting anybody officially. I would meet people. I would go out with some of the other young diplomats from different countries, and we would go to the parks, and people would kind of hesitantly come up to us. They still were very friendly, although the governments were very, very hostile to each other. I mean, this was a very bad time. It was during the Korean War. There were posters in Moscow showing American soldiers shooting up North Korean women with poison. I mean, it was really... And yet the people would come up and say, oh, you're from America. How nice. Welcome to Russia. I mean, you got very mixed reactions.
Yeah. And as you mentioned, not too long.
I worked in the embassy, so I worked full time. My summer job. And I didn't spend a lot of time sort of out on the streets getting to see how people were doing.
You mentioned not too long into your father's ambassadorship, he's declared persona non grata, so, you know, kicked out by Stalin and banished from the Soviet Union. What was the public story behind his ouster, and what details were kept secret?
Well, the ostensible reason for his expulsion was that he was being flown to England to participate in a conference, and the plane stopped in Berlin. And there was a press conference because people were so interested in what was going on in Russia. And at the end of the press conference, a young journalist, but my father was under the impression the press conference had ended and this was just a young man. In fact, it was a journalist. And he asked my father what it was like living in the Soviet Union in 1952. And my father said, well, it reminds me of when I was in Berlin before the war. And so Stalin, it didn't happen overnight. I think a week or two later, declared that my father was expelled because he had compared communist Russia with fascist Germany. Hmm. And that was the ostensible reason for the public reason for the expulsion. The other reason was that they had just discovered through our security people a bug, which the Russians almost diabolically had put in the seal of the United States. And this bug was able to receive and transmit messages and also to be shut off. And when it was shut off, it couldn't be detected. So it had been there quite some time and simple detection devices hadn't found it. It was in our upstairs living room. And finally, it was found during this period I was there. And they asked my father to carry the bug out in his pocket because ambassadors cannot be searched. And my father thinks that was another big reason that he was expelled. And if anybody's interested in seeing this device, it's now at the Spy Museum in Washington, D.C.
All right. So you meet and marry C.K. McClatchy, a journalist several years older than you, who came from an old and distinguished newspaper family. So describe the transition into the McClatchy family.
Well, the McClatchy family wasn't such a difficult transition, but we lived in Sacramento, and that was very different from all the capitals of Europe. It just was a totally different world. And, it was California, but it was California, not like San Francisco and Los Angeles, which are sort of cosmopolitan cities. Sacramento at that time was not very cosmopolitan. It was wonderful. It was friendly. The weather was nice. A lot of good things happened there, and I had three children there. But it was a shock. Mm. And I was, again, different. I was the person that didn't quite fit in.
So you mentioned you're married for several years, you have three children, and then you find out that CK is gay. Your marriage hasn't been solid, and you decide to divorce. So you have three young children, and you're setting out on your own. This is when you embark on creating a career for yourself. Do you think you would have pursued a career if you had stayed married?
No, because actually I was offered a job. I was offered a job on the local PBS station, which I would have loved. But the family did not want me. You know, they felt it was inappropriate for a wife to work. Mm. So I don't think I would have worked if I'd stayed married. I did a lot of volunteer work. All the years until I started seriously working, I always was involved with some sort of volunteer work. I learned a lot. You can learn a lot from being
a
volunteer.
Yeah. It's still work. You're just not getting paid for it. Yeah.
It's still work. It's just unpaid work. Yeah. You're absolutely right.
Yeah. It's during this time that you receive a call from your father about Svetlana Stalin, Joseph Stalin's daughter, who defected. And your father invites her to stay at the family farm in Pennsylvania. And you agree to bring your children east to host her. So what were your hopes for that time with Svetlana, and what was the reality?
Oh, my hopes were huge. I was very excited. I mean, the thought that I was going to have this unique experience to take care of Stalin's daughter, it just seemed extraordinary. I remember the most of all going and buying this precious notebook. I was going to write down every word. And I always wanted to be a writer. I had some thought that maybe a article or something would come out of this. And then as it turned out, of course, not only did I have my children who were aged 4, 6, and 8, but my sister and her husband, they went into the Peace Corps and I got her two children aged 4 and 6. So I had 5 children under the age of 8 plus Svetlana. Everybody was on a different time schedule. Everybody was on a different diet or food. And also at that time, my father was very worried that she was going to be kidnapped by the KGB and that it was really dangerous to have her at the family farm. So he said, I couldn't tell any of my friends, or I couldn't get anybody to help in the house because he was afraid that if the word got out, then we would be more apt to be, you know, that something bad could happen. Mm. And so I ended up, you know, I said once I ended up with great opportunity and I ended up in the kitchen. But, you know, people had to be fed three meals a day, and we didn't even have a washer and dryer. It was a very sort of simple, it was a big house, but it didn't have any modern conveniences. So it was complicated. And she's very up and down with how she feels about people. I think she always was until she died. And for a while, she was very fond of me, and then she sort of turned on me. But in that case, she really was Stalin's daughter.
You visited the Soviet Union twice as a guide and interpreter in the 60s and 70s. One trip was with Senator Ted Kennedy, and the other, again, with Joan Baez. So tell us about that first trip with Senator Kennedy and your role.
I will, but just to make it more, I took lots of trips to the Soviet Union.
Yeah,
these were not the only ones.
No, I was saying as a guide and interpreter, though, right? Did you take these?
I did it for. Other things too, but these were the most dramatic. Well, my role, the Kennedy trip, was way back when. It was 1974, and we had his wife Joan and his two older children, Kara and little Teddy. So it was the family going, and we were the personal guests of Brezhnev. We had a villa that was assigned to us. We had an airplane assigned to us so we could leave our sweaters on if we wanted to. I mean, it was an extraordinarily lavish trip. When you're the guests of the head of the Soviet Union, you know, no expense was spared. And it was, but my job was often to translate. It was to find people, it was to keep track of all their presents because they were continually being presents, and they had to give anything that was worth over $25 to the Smithsonian. So I was keeping track of that. I was also arranging for the schedule for the kids because they had their own schedule. I mean, they didn't trot along with us to meet with heads of state. It was very exciting.
Yeah, sounds it. But now Senator Kennedy wanted to meet with Jewish dissidents while he was there, and that required him to evade the KGB to do so. So he enlists your help for that. Tell us that story.
Well, as I said, we lived in a villa, and we were assigned hosts who appeared in the morning before we had breakfast with us, were with us until we said we were going to bed. And, you know, they were all KGB, but, you know, with some charm, and they tried, and it wasn't like they weren't glaring at us or anything like that. They were very acting as hosts, but nonetheless, they were KGB. And so they didn't, the senator and his staff, and they had a very small staff. There were only three people on his staff. One was a photographer, and then we had a foreign policy advisor, and then a sort of staff aide. But they obviously didn't want the KGB to know they were meeting with the dissidents because they would have insisted on coming along and nobody would have talked. So, I mean, the senator wouldn't have learned anything. So he figured out that if I could keep the KGB amused, they could kind of slip out one by one. And at first I had to get them a car because we were isolated and this villa was not on the street. It was in the middle of a park. So I was able to get I sort of talked to the driver, got him to stay, although he was very nervous about it, didn't understand why he was being asked to do this. And then as people started slipping away as if they were going to the restroom or something, I just kept lively chattering away with the KGB. And by the time when a maid came in and said, "Goodness, the car is gone and the senator is gone," they were already gone, and the KGB was really angry with me.
I bet.
They left. Yeah. They all packed up. They left right away. They were just so mad. They said, "Where is he?" And I said, "I don't know."
So you accompany, as I mentioned, Joan Baez on a trip to the Soviet Union. What was the purpose of that trip?
She wanted to meet, you know, Joan Baez has always been a political animal as well as being a beautiful, beautiful singer. And she's always had causes. And she wanted to meet with Andrei Sakharov, the famous physicist, who was a big human rights advocate at that time. And he was being watched very carefully by the Russian government. So when we actually did meet him, they had taken we met his second wife's daughter. She had emigrated and lived in Boston. And she had told us exactly where the building was where he lived and exactly where we had a map where the apartment was. And so when we went, they had taken the numbers off the building so that we couldn't find the building, but, you know, we knew where it was. And then inside, they turned the lights out, and they'd taken all the apartment numbers off. It was kind of extraordinary. I felt my way down the corridor, feeling, counting doors. And Joan was with me, and they started out really trying to converse. And in the beginning, they weren't completely on the same page, I would say. And then Joan offered to sing, and she has this beautiful, beautiful voice. And Sakharov absolutely melted, and then they both got interested and had a very interesting conversation. Mm. Of course, I was translating everything. Mm. So I was a translator and organizer.
Right. Now, you had concerns that Joan was bringing undeclared money into the Soviet Union. What was that money for, and why was that a concern?
Well, it's a big concern. It's illegal to bring more than $10,000 into the Soviet Union. And to this day, I never saw the money. I mean, the irony is when I assumed there was money, it was in the guitar. And the other person that was with us said it was in the guitar. I never saw it. I don't, to this day, I couldn't swear it was there. I never saw it. But she was offering when we were meeting with some dissidents too. And they completely stopped the conversation and wrote down, please do not offer money. It's, you know, we will be in trouble. And that's, of course, not what she wanted to do, is get people in trouble. So I kept worrying that somehow this money was going to get us into a lot of trouble. But we, each time we sort of evaded it. So it was, it's a chapter of kind of adventures. And also a chapter of this, I mean, she really is a wonderful person.
Yeah. Talk about your work with the Soviet Youth Orchestra and what you hope to achieve through that collaboration.
Well, you know, this applies to our relations with Russia today. At the times when governments are sort of frozen or they're hostile to each other, I think citizen diplomacy plays a much bigger role. And a lot of us whose personal goals were to end the Cold War, if it could be ended, decided the way to do it was to work on cultural projects. And one of them was the American Soviet Youth Orchestra, which was the brainchild of Fred Starr, who at that point was the president of Oberlin College. So we got together, and I was in Russia working on another project, but I, by sheer accident, met the number two man at the Ministry of Culture and told him about this idea. And he kind of thought it was interesting, and so I was able to go to the ministry and pitch the idea. And then I ended up working as the founding executive director of this orchestra, which we created from scratch. In this country, we had auditions all the way across the country. And the Russians, their musicians all came from Moscow Conservatory of Music. But the rehearsal period was at Oberlin School of Music, which is a famous music school. And then we ended up touring both countries. Mm-hmm. And it was very exciting to see these young musicians. The big thing they had in common was, of course, their music. They didn't talk the same language, but they talked the language of music. And to watch them become friends and colleagues and how they worked together. And I think seeing them seeing them play together all over the America, the audience who saw it realized Americans and Russians could get along.
Mm-hmm.
It was a very exciting project to work.
Yeah, it sounds it. You ended up back in Russia for 2 months while you were working on a project called A Day in the Life, and you were the photographer. And we should mention that you had made a name for yourself as a photographer at this point. And while you were there, you reconnected with a childhood Russian friend, Valya. And what did you learn What did you learn about her from her about the lives of Soviet women, and how did it influence your later work?
Oh, it did enormously. We hadn't seen each other. She was a friend, my closest friend when I went to school in 1944. We had not had any contact for 40 years. So to have somebody appear in your life. She was an architect, and she had been at the House of Architects when there was a delegation from Princeton. And somehow she knew that my father was at Princeton, and she got somebody to take a note out to my father, and that's how we reconnected. And then we spent, by this time, it was later, and you could, you know, in the beginning, I would go very carefully to her apartment, and we wouldn't speak in the hall so people wouldn't know I had an accent and things like that. But of course, things became more open. And I spent hours, days talking to her. And a lot of what I know about the Soviet Union came from Valya. She was just amazing because as time went on, she was free to talk about all the things you couldn't talk about in those early years. So I had a very unique opportunity. And, you know, she'd known me. We'd known each other since we were 12.
Yeah.
We had a kind of trust that not everybody has, I think.
Yeah. So what did you learn about the lives of Soviet women from her?
I'll tell you what shocked me the most. Her daughter became pregnant, and I said, "Oh, how wonderful, Valya, you're going to be a grandmother. Isn't that exciting?" She said, "No, it's horrible." She said, "I don't want to be a grandmother. When you become a grandmother, you take care of the child, because the parents usually work. And you have no life after that." She said, "I won't have a social life. I won't see people. I will be with this baby all the time."
Wow.
She was not looking forward to that part of her life. And that was one of the first things I just realized suddenly in a country where everybody worked. I mean, all the women worked. And in my country, a lot of women work in the United States. But at that point, my mother didn't, my aunts didn't, so I'd sort of grown up in a world of women that were working, but they were working in the house as mothers and housekeepers and hostesses.
Now, you met Vladimir Putin.
So it was very different.
Yeah, you met Vladimir Putin when he was deputy mayor of Leningrad. What were your impressions of him?
My main impression was he was the coldest man I ever met, and that was a very strong impression at that time. We met somewhat accidentally. I was supposed to meet with the mayor of St. Petersburg, who I had known, not well, but I knew him slightly. And I was running my own, I had at that point evolved into running my own business consulting firm, Sovis, and giving advice to American businessmen. They were all men who were going over to the former Soviet Union to start small businesses or businesses. And I had wanted to meet with the mayor to discuss a client's interest in the port of St. Petersburg. At the last minute, the Sobchak, the mayor, was not around. He was called away, and they said, "No, you're going to have to meet with the deputy mayor, whose name is Vladimirovich Putin." And I'd heard of him, but I was kind of annoyed. I didn't want to be meeting with a deputy. I wanted to meet with the mayor. It turned out he was kind of annoyed because he thought a woman president of a company was sort of strange, and I think he just didn't want to meet with an American woman. But we had no choice, and we met, and we talked for about 20-25 minutes. I mean, just the two of us in Russian, because he at that point wasn't speaking publicly in English. And so it was interesting.
Yeah.
I never dreamt that I was talking with the man who would become the head of the whole of Russia.
Right. So as you look at Russia, the Russia of today under Putin's leadership, what strikes you about both the government and the lives of the Russian people?
Well, the lives are in many ways, at least in Moscow and St. Petersburg, the lives are infinitely economically better. I mean, there's a lot of money around, there's fancy cars, people now have they don't live in communal apartments. They're not all squashed in. It's a very different world over there. I mean, before, the one thing that, however, people look back on it that they still in a way miss was people have said to me, "We were all on the same level. We were all poor, but we were poor together." Now they have this the big difference between rich and poor, which we too have in places.
Yeah.
But it's perhaps more dramatic for them because they didn't have that before.
Right.
If there was an advantage, and I don't know if you call it an advantage, in Stalin's Russia, is that everybody was more or less on the same level in a way.
So what do you make of the on-again, off-again relationship between President Trump and Putin?
Well, I think that, I mean, I suspect that the Russians were meddling in our election, and, you know, they are capable of hacking and doing all those things. I don't know quite why President Trump had I think his idea maybe was in the beginning that he was going to kind of solve U.S.-Russia relations by being flattering and nice to Putin. And then when that sort of, he ran into hostility from Congress, he kind of dropped that. But God knows where it's going now, I think. I mean, things are changing every day.
Right. You've really worked hard to bridge gaps between the U.S. and Russia. What do you think is yet to be done?
Well, I think there's more bridging of gaps to be done. We can't go to war. And so my hope, my fervent hope, is that we will get on a better relationship with Russia. And sooner or later, you know, things change. And one thing about being as old as I am and having lived from the time when we were allies, after all, during World War II, to extreme enemies during the Korean War, back to being friends again. Now we're going through a difficult period. The one thing you do learn is that things don't stay the same. And while right now it looks like we're frozen in this conflict, I'm sure things will change one way or the other. And the reasons for the change, I can't tell you, but I'm sure there will be changes.
So then what would you advise doing to bring the countries closer together?
Well, I still think that citizen diplomacy does a lot when governments can't do things. I think it's helpful when the Bolshoi Ballet comes over here and we all go see it. It's helpful when our jazz musicians go over there and play. It's helpful when we have art shows of each other's art. There are a lot of things you can do to. We do cooperate with the Russians in the Arctic, and I think that's very exciting. I mean, in the Arctic, we're all fighting nature in a way. And you just don't own the Arctic or the Antarctic. And so there are areas where we get along. And I think those should be maybe advertised a little more.
Right. Now, you spent part of the year in Martha's Vineyard. What brought you to the island originally? And given the many places that you have lived, what compels you to return?
Well, I love the island. It's that simple. I think it reminded me of Norway a little bit. I mean, I love the ocean. I love being on the sea. I love the smell of the sea. And there's a very special feeling in Martha's Vineyard. And I knew when I... In fact, it's funny. At first, I didn't think of getting a house there because I thought it was too expensive. And I was going to get a little cottage in upstate New York. I had some dumb idea. And then when I went over to Ukraine, I had 4.5 very interesting years living in Ukraine and empowering Ukrainian women. It was economic. It was helping them start small businesses. But when I returned, on the plane coming home, I thought, you know, I've been empowering Ukrainian women for 4.5 years. How about empowering me? Mm-hmm. And that's when I went to my children and I said, I'm getting a house at Martha's Vineyard. And no matter what it costs, if I don't have enough money, I'll get a very small house. But that's where I want to be and that's what I'm going to do. And in the end, my children went along with me when we have a family house, which we all love, and they come. And you know, I've always thought of it as a very special place that I have very special feelings for.
Yeah. Grace Kennan-Warnicki's recently published memoir is Daughter of the Cold War. She'll be giving a talk at the Vineyard Playhouse Saturday, June 23rd at 4 p.m. We'll have more information about the book and her talk at our website, capeandislands.org. Just click on the point. Grace Kennan-Warnicki, thanks so much for talking with us. You have such an interesting life and so many interesting stories. Thank you for being with us.
Well, thank you, Mindy, and it was lovely to be on your program, which I listen to when I'm at the Vineyard.
Well, thanks for doing that. I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.